Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organisational transformation and on to changes in society and the world. My name is Andy Pollane. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, leadership coach, educator and writer. My guest today is K.A. McKercher, a designer and writer living on Aboriginal land in Australia. They have over 10 years' experience leading social innovation and co-design approaches across Australia and New Zealand, previously working as principal at the Australian Centre of Social Innovation and the Innovation Unit, and they are currently working within the New South Wales government. They write in their book, "Relying heavily on sticky notes privileges those who can think quickly, are highly literate and literary, and are well-versed in thinking in headlines. Anyone who can't do that is generally excluded and left bewildered by the pace of commercial design methods." K.A., welcome to Power of 10.
Thank you for having me, Andy.
So I'm going to return back to that quote, which I'm guessing is where the title of your book, Beyond Sticky Notes, came from. But I'm interested in your own journey first. So, you know, what was your pathway from where you came from to here?
So I accidentally went to design school after really wanting to go to art school and not having that be framed as a real job. Sort of ending up in design and architecture, and then being also at the very same time very interested in social science as well. So I studied design and I studied anthropology at the same time, which was fortuitous because those things, I guess, would go on to become quite entangled. But at that time, I sort of thought, geez, design's interesting, it's fun, it perhaps doesn't have a very robust understanding of people and of sort of methods of understanding people. And I thought anthropology is interesting, but it feels a bit stagnant and a bit othering, and we don't really make things. So it felt sort of interesting to join these two things together. And very soon after design school, sort of working for a company called Optimal Usability that doesn't exist anymore, but was a fabulous company in its time. And one of the early projects that I began working on was around the translation of legislation, which in New Zealand was around how we would better care for kids who were at the precipice of perhaps entering the child protection system. And the project was really to say, can we work in a place-based way, or can we work in particular communities and with communities to take this legislative change and turn it into service design, a sort of functional and practical service design. And very naively, I just sort of hurled myself into this with the things I thought I knew about, like doing journey maps and personas and workshops and, you know, having sticky notes and butcher's paper. And those things were just rejected, of course, by communities who were really confused about who I was and why I was there and what I was doing and why I had so much arrogance and and so little cultural competency, actually, being a white New Zealander. And that gave me a bit of a taste for design as applied into a social community setting. Probably a bit of a taste for how little I reasonably knew about that and what my role should be or could be. And then I guess set me on a bit of a path of working in a more community-led design process across lots of different settings, predominantly health and domestic violence and child protection. And that sort of just amassed lots of different experiences about designing with people, particularly in community, not often in boardrooms, not often in offices. And then a little bit down that track, I sort of thought, well, this has been interesting and fantastic, and all this needs to go somewhere, so hence writing a book. But then I was also a bit curious about what it's like to be on the inside and to work at a different level and layer of the system, and decided to then start working in government and seeing what was possible and what kinds of conditions I could create from inside of government to perhaps have people, you know, like myself or much better, more competent versions of myself, come and sort of lead more community accountable work.
So, I mean, I think quite a lot of obviously service designers end up or attracted to government actually, because in that sort of systems level of view that you often take of the work we're doing, of, you know, where are things going wrong, and one of the places where you can actually make some significant change across that entire system is obviously is in government. At the same time, you know, you get there and you work with those departments, and there's often an awful lot of good intention, but they're sort of mired in process that slows them down, and that's part of the kind of systems problem. What's been your experience? And I know you're already working there, so probably you might want to be careful about what you say. But, you know, given what you just said about, you know, coming in, let's be kind of honest. I've worked in a, you know, in a consultancy with all the kind of glossiness of that, and been one of those people who's kind of come into one of those departments to do some work. Mm-hmm. And I'm very aware of, you know, of how that kind of arrogance, I guess, that you were just talking about before. What's been your experience, you know, of trying to bring these kinds of methods and process and thinking into those departments, perhaps in a different way to how external consultants would do so?
I think the thing we get the opportunity to do when we're in a place and for an extended period of time is, and not dissimilar to co-design in this respect, work in a very relationship first approach, right? Where we don't come in with assumptions about what people are and aren't doing, the capabilities they do and don't have. And I think some language, and I think it was Jeremy Myerson who presented this language of perhaps the goal is design infused, not design led. So this language of design led, you know, is out there.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's active, it's strong, it's a bit bossy. And my experience has certainly been that design infused is more helpful not only to truly bring design methods and skill sets into an organization, but also just to value other skills and capabilities that people have, insights they have about their work. And perhaps, you know, I guess allow them to work with their own curiosity about what is it they want to learn and discover, as opposed to us telling them that or suggesting that they're somehow wrong or bad for not knowing or not having had the opportunity to know. And actually, I think there's many things for designers to reflect on in terms of the pace in which we expect change to happen, which is often admirable but unreasonable. And also perhaps that one of the reasons why people don't engage in design processes is sometimes because of the sheer operational demand. And if someone has this enormous operational demand placed on them, it's not exactly easy to step out of that and engage in, you know, what we might think of as a gold standard design process. Mm. So in some ways, the way that I've more so thought about it is, what can I curate for folks across the organization, almost like a tasting platter of different conversations, capabilities, micro learning type activities that just sort of builds up in a way that's reasonable to the demands that people have on themselves when they're in operational roles and positions, but also keeps kind of stoking the fire of building up maybe different mindsets or different skill sets and coming to see how they're relevant for a very specific context. Because I guess much of design is framed perhaps unhelpfully as very generic, and as being these tools that just sort of bob about in the world. And it can be really difficult to make the conceptual leap between what would that tool mean for me, how would I bring it into my context, and how might it need adapting. And I guess as someone working on the inside, there's a translational role perhaps in sort of seeing the massive plethora of tools and meaningfully bringing those in and telling stories about them and adapting them and even doing work and then using that as a way of saying, see, we used that thing and it was quite good and people said it was quite good. Do you want to use it too? I'll give you a hand.
Right. And then you get the sort of snowball effect of more, you know, I say the snowball effect. I have this expression called the sort of umbrella in the rain, which is, you know, at the beginning, everyone's like, why have you got an umbrella? I'm speaking as an Englishman here. Right? Why have you got an umbrella? You know, and then, of course, you know, when it starts raining, everyone wants to be under your umbrella, and that sort of success attracts success. And it's a slow process, I think. I think that your point about designers being frustrated at the lack of pace, particularly in a, you know, with the noise, if you like, from Silicon Valley of faster is always better, right? And the kind of speed and the your point about designers being frustrated at that kind of lack of pace is really kind of well placed and well observed. I think that that's a we forget to take people on the journey with us and kind of not just forget. I suspect we're probably deeply impatient about it all.
I think so, but it can be shaming, right? Like we all know that shame is not a good change strategy, and to suggest to people that they should somehow be ashamed of the things they don't know or haven't had the opportunity to learn.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is that it's actually very easy to create a product. It's very difficult to then see all the layers of which need to be aligned to make that an actual part of the organization. That's an implementation, not just an installation of something.
Yeah, yeah. I have to defend service design a second here. The reason why the book that I co-wrote with Ben and Lavrans was called From Insight to Implementation was for that very reason, right? That this idea that otherwise you are stuck in sticky notes of land and you've sort of come up with some concepts, but not really the implementation is the tough bit, which I might come to actually. But just talking about shame, I've just noticed you'd had the there was a piece we said about having courageous conversations and are you enabling people to take off their armor, which I don't know if that was was that a direct reference to Brené Brown or was it just happens to be the same language because of this, you know, where we were talking about shame. It's a difficult area, right?
Yeah, and I wonder if there's anyone who's gotten away with not being deeply influenced by Brené Brown, because the way she speaks about this is so accessible and warm and friendly. Mm. And, you know, certainly it does come, you know, and be inspired by Brené Brown, but it also comes from a flavor of community organizing and activism that is less the pointy, yelly.
Yeah.
Style and a little bit more the, you know, the whole, you know, let's not build a fence, but maybe have a much longer table. And, you know, even Krista Tippett, I think the host of On Being is another person that models this kind of hospitality and invitation, which, you know, really some of the ingredients that I guess I speak about a lot in the book, but also speak about a lot in design practice that perhaps we've maybe forgotten some of the hospitality-based aspects of convening people and hosting conversations.
Yeah. And as a kind of sideline to that, I mean, you've been, you're in New South Wales, right? You're in Sydney, yeah?
Mm.
Sydney hasn't had the lockdown quite that Melbourne has had, but, you know, I guess you've, talking about sort of hosting and hospitality, there's a lot that I guess we're naturally attuned to from, you know, hosting, being a host of people in a space, put it that way. And there's also a lot that, as you point out, that we're completely kind of ignorant of or unaware of or, unconscious of or just not getting right in those physical spaces. I'd be interested to know what your experience has been actually of doing this, trying to apply some of these things in the, you know, remote space.
Mm, it's a good question. And I think for me, many of the same principles and practices apply. So, you know, I think it's Priya Parker and others who have often said, you know, it's something like 80% of the work of being in the room happens outside of the room and before you even get to the room in the first place. So I guess in the virtual environment, I'm still trying to do things like build relationships with people one-to-one and have conversations with them ahead of there being any sort of group-based thing that's going to occur. I think there's really small things like asking people, you know, is there anything that you'd like to tell me or share with me by which will make the session more accessible for you or more engaging for you? And that might be a small thing like, you know, make it okay that I can turn my camera off or make sure you've enabled captions or, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff there.
Yeah.
I think small like novelties can play a role as well around maybe there's, you know, almost like Easter eggs built into invitations, built into virtual convenings and afterwards. I think there's a lot that we can do around buddying people up. So there's a greater sense of safety even in a virtual room. You know, there's a huge wealth of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely noticeable, you know, in breakout rooms. Although So there's probably two sides to this. It's definitely noticeable in breakout rooms that you can, you know, in those virtual spaces where, you know, you can to say to everyone, hey, come up with a thing and share it with the entire group of, you know, 30 people on this video chat is obviously quite, you know, a demand on well, quite a lot of people actually. But, you know, to work in a small breakout group together and then kind of come back and report as your group or something like that, that kind of helps, definitely helps create that sort of sense of safety in a group and take it less, the focus less on the person. One of the downsides of breakout groups is although you can kind of jump around them, you can't kind of see them all at once. Right? And I think one of the things you see in a visual space is, oh, there's a table over there where one person is kind of not included. You know, and the other three people are kind of, you know, up at the wall, you know, doing whatever they're doing. And this other person seems to be a bit checked out. Have you encountered, you know, I mean, presumably you've encountered that in physical space. You know, I saw you nodding before. Have you kind of come up with any ways to deal with that in the virtual?
Yeah. So the best tool that I've found is I build all of the breakout rooms in advance and deliberately curate who's going to be in that specific breakout room. And particularly when I'm teaching design or design related skills, I'll always have someone in the room that I've sort of briefed ahead of time around these are the things I'd like you to look for, what I'd like you to exercise as kind of a peer-to-peer facilitator in your own group. And even as a really simple thing, making it really safe for people to leave the breakout room and come back to the shared space. So we had a session where we had, I think, about 170 people. And I said to everyone, breakout rooms just aren't for all of us. And for some of us, they create a huge amount of anxiety and we just hate them. So I let everyone know and actually showed them a screenshot and said, this is how you can leave. And you don't have to feel bad leaving. The main space will just have some quiet music. You can turn off your camera. And here's an independent thing you might like to do or think about. So I think there's a power dynamic here, though, that as the host, we set what's permissible, right? And even if we don't say it, people come up with their own sense of what the unspoken norms are. So one of the most powerful things through lockdown I found was just to say to people, just come as you are. You don't need to apologize for your kids jumping on your back, your cat sitting on your computer, you know, the blinds that you don't really like behind you and you have this perception that they're not professional. It's okay. Like, and if you're feeling a bit frazzled and if you just start crying in the middle of the session, it's going to be okay. And I think for people even just to hear that explicit permission, I notice a massive shift.
Yeah, that's true. That's a very good idea. So I guessing those kinds of ideas also were the sort of itch that you sort of wrote the book to scratch. So tell me, people write books usually because the one that they want doesn't exist and there's a sort of, there's an itch they want to scratch themselves. Sometimes also born around out of frustration. So your book's called Beyond Sticky Notes, Co-Design for Real, and then Mindsets, Methods, and Movements. And the real is kind of is underlined, which I'm guessing, you know, you've been talking about a bit already. What was the genesis of this?
It's a few things. So I don't know if you've noticed this in Europe, but certainly in Australia and also in Aotearoa, New Zealand, there's been this, I don't think explosion is too wild word to use of the language of co-design. So we're seeing it everywhere from organizational strategies, Royal Commission recommendations, and there's a great deal of projects that go out to market to say, you know, we want an agency to come work with us and do co-design. My observation was most of those things weren't what I had understood that to mean. And when I say what I had understood, I mean sort of connecting to the lineage of, you know, participatory design practice or emancipatory design practice or community-led design practice that particularly I think back home in Aotearoa is a much bigger, more burgeoning field of people who I guess are seeing design not as a toolkit but a catalyst for more even power dynamics or more opportunities for people to play a role in the decisions that shape their lives. So I was feeling this dissonance, I guess, between the language that people were using and then what was actually happening, which was really just kind of fancy workshops and actually not even very good workshops. And as you say, I was looking across the market and what I could see was super convoluted academic texts that are just not accessible. I could see little bits and bobs that people had put together, maybe a blog here, a blog there. But the other extreme was these toolkits that were all tools and no connection to what would you need to unlearn and what would you need to be even to be successful, and what's actually the social movement side of it as well, that, you know, really this isn't just about jazzy new methods, but the opportunity for greater civic participation and, you know, greater connection at neighbourhoods and between organisations and the people they're set up to serve or to partner with. So I felt there was a gap, and that seemed to be the case, particularly once the book was out and people were sort of saying, you know, I've been looking for this. Yeah, so I guess I wanted to write something that had these three aspects. So I wanted to say something about the social movement side of things.
Yeah.
And what some of the, I guess, particular literacies around power and privilege that might be helpful or are helpful for designers to have a much greater sense of, or anyone can be in co-design. It's not just designers. The second part, I wanted to talk much more so about maybe some of the mindsets that we don't often see talked about in design, and hospitality in particular being one of those things, but also the grittier parts of things like asking people to be in ambiguity and whether that's actually a reasonable or possible request.
Yeah.
And if it is, when and how, and how does that get supported? And then pretty light on the methods and really focusing on the model of care for co-design, which is sort of one of the core frameworks, which is really about bringing about some more trauma-aware practices into doing design and convening groups of people, and just generally not trying to replicate the great deal of excellent design books and design methods that are already out there that tell us how to do things like generative design research.
Yeah. There's a large part of this is really about designing the process, right? Or kind of applying a level of thoughtfulness and detail. And there's an incredible amount of it. I think it's very rich on that. To kind of not so much the process itself, not even the kind of actual work that you're doing, but the preconditions in which all of this is taking place, and applying the same amount of effort to that. And you talk about, you know, conditions for co-design is really kind of like the first kind of chunk of it. And, you know, one of them, you have these kind of four aspects of support and sponsorship, time and money, culture and climate, and commitments. And particularly those first three, so the support and sponsorship, time and money and commitments are all, I would argue, proxies for how important people think this stuff is. Right, because if they're not there, and a common thing, and you mentioned it before, is that, you know, co-design is expensive, and we talked about the speed thing as well. I can imagine you've had the sort of pushback on this going to slow us down or whatever. You know, there's no budget until it's something that someone decides is important, and then suddenly there's budget, right? So, you know, a lot of this feels like what you're doing is trying to kind of surface this as not only just as, you know, this is important because this is the right way to treat people, but this is important because otherwise you don't get the outcomes you're after. You know, I think designers tend to talk about design too much, actually, to stakeholders and people who are kind of, you know, might be pushing back on them, or people they're trying to convince. You know, when you've been doing this work, both when you've been doing this work and maybe when you've been sort of talking or teaching or whatever about this, what have been some of the kind of main pushbacks that you've had on this way of working?
So I think that I don't have time, or we don't have time, is a big one. And I think there's some reframing around that, around, you know, going slow now to go fast later, or thinking about future liabilities that may arise from not having sufficiently invested, you know, in the early days. I think another sort of objection or a thing that people get hung up on is they've misheard something along the way about everyone has to be involved, or everyone should be involved. And I think this is a great fallacy. That one, that's possible, and two, that therefore everyone has to be involved in the same ways. And I guess what I particularly advocate for is that we think about people who know, people who care, people who perhaps haven't got to have a seat in the conversation but have important insights to share, and really prioritizing those people as the core co-design team, if you will, and then that there are, as we both know, a great huge list of many different ways in which people can be involved that may be more about breadth than depth, or they might mix those things.
Right. And so I think, you know, one of the things that happens when people say we need to be inclusive in this is like everyone has to have their say, right? And everyone has to be involved. And then it becomes a kind of political thing of, well, we can't speak to those people unless we keep bringing these people. Is that the kind of thing you're saying ends up happening? And those people aren't necessarily the right people, or they may even be unsafe people to be in, or make the space unsafe. Right?
Or there are people who, whilst have views that arguably are being, you know, that they deserve to share, are views that are already well understood and well represented. Right, right, and I think the part that designers are very guilty of, and we all are because of our impulse to want to create something new and maybe create some kind of shrine to ourselves, as well as that we often sort of parachute into context without sufficiently understanding what's already known. And I think that does mean that we often then go back over old ground, as opposed to sort of saying, where are the cracks? Where does the road end? You know, where are people falling in the river? That just got to be a very complicated metaphor. But,
That's all right.
I think there's a different way of thinking about this, and it does require being brave enough to say, well, should everyone be involved? And that's perhaps actually not inclusion. That's perhaps just a very unsophisticated understanding or unsophisticated way of thinking about it.
I mean, you've talked a lot about, you know, power structures, creating safe spaces, and building, I wrote down a quote, you said, building trust and relationships before offering tools or methods, which I feel like we probably do the other way around most of the time as designers. And, you know, and I've seen it, actually I've seen it done, and interestingly, because you, given your background, there's a guy called Chris Haywood who's been on, who I used to work with, who's been on the show, comes from a anthropology background, and I've seen him really brilliantly in a workshop where it was a large group of people. There are lots of different kind of parts of, there are lots of third-party service providers for this particular thing. And one of those third-party service providers was considered to be the problem, basically. And the woman who was, you know, representing that service, there was kind of a pile-on starting to happen in the space. And she then, understandably, started to become quite defensive, which then started to kind of lock down where things were going to go in terms of kind of opening up the problem space and all of that stuff. And I saw Chris just, well, actually be incredibly empathetic and human, but had just had a real ability to kind of diffuse that, and not only to kind of, you know, help that woman feel more included and wanted, and to sort of, which helped her kind of dial down her defenses, take off her armor actually, but also at the same time stop the others in the room from the kind of pile on. And over the course of sort of 2 days, it was brilliant to see. I don't know, you know, if I asked him about it, he probably would remember it. I don't know that it was sort of such a sort of, it just seemed to be something he was very kind of attuned to, I think, from his anthropology background, actually, of understanding of being a, you know, stranger in a strange land, and I'm not actually part of this community, and, you know, I'm colonizing this community as a, you know, you talked actually about a design being, particularly when working with Indigenous people, design being a colonizing practice. And there's that nice piece from Katerina Davis in there about, you know, we need more designers, more Maori designers and good allies, and no more white saviors. You know, so many people assume we need something that we already have. And that kind of skill to shape that safe space in the middle of seeing it, or to recorrect a dynamic where a space that might have been assumed to be safe starts to become not safe, was a real skill, I thought. And it was really nice to sort of see in practice. And you talk about kind of, we can have a lot of sort of good intentions and set up stuff as best we think we can. But the same problem arises there, which is, this is our kind of guess of what we think should be the safe space. How do you deal with a kind of correcting, you know, what we think is a safe space might not be? How do we do that better? Mm. And then in the middle of it, when you realize something is not going as it should, how do you correct for that?
Mm. Look, I think the first thing to acknowledge is safe. And I want to say safe enough, because I don't think that it's possible for all spaces.
Right, yeah.
Like, we're human beings and we're colliding into each other and we're, you know, saying and doing things. So I think safe enough for me is the framing, and within that, according to whom. And I guess in my work I take a particularly special focus on folks who will not be the highest on the matrix of domination, who will not have the most authority in the room, or for whom an identity or experience is likely to produce an othering kind of effect. And I'll often have quite a few conversations with people ahead of time about what safe enough might be like. And, you know, often people, because they've thought about this often really a lot, particularly survivors of different kinds, have done a lot of work and had to do a lot of work around how do I feel safe or safe enough. So often people have really practical suggestions like, I don't want to hear what everyone's jobs are at the start of the session. I want to hear who people are in their community. And I just don't want to be shamed that I'm, for example, not in employment right now, and that person's got three PhDs. So people will often make suggestions about what that could be like. And I guess as a somewhat, you know, a person who's facilitated a fair amount in this space, I've also got a bit in my own memory bank of things that I might draw from. I think it's a really different matter as to when the space becomes unsafe. And I think the people that I know that are really good at doing this experience or have experienced some exclusion in their own lives that allows them to, this sounds a little bit kind of woo-woo, but feel a sense that something's broken in the relational space and someone's done something that's awkward, that's harmed someone. And, you know, I think this is where the whole courageous conversation things come from. I don't know that people who are hosting workshops always see it as their role to take a corrective action of some kind and to practice calling in. So let me give an example. I was in a workshop some time ago, and the workshop was about LGBT health, and there were these very lovely consultants who were running the workshop, and became clear to me that they weren't in fact running the workshop, they'd just set up the room, so there wasn't sort of anyone running anything. And I'd made a particular comment in my experience as a non-binary person and a very aggressive older cisgendered person sort of said to me, oh, that's fine, but we all just need to grow up here and stop being so worried about language. And that would have been the perfect opportunity for the person hosting the conversation to say, we have already committed in this space to prioritize the safety of LGBT people and to listen deeply and not to minimize. But instead, these people just kind of sat back and they were very awkward and nothing happened. And of course, that just reinforced this power dynamic of it was somehow okay for that to happen. So I think as a facilitator, we have to have the capacity in that moment to call out and call in at the same time and offer invitations that people might think about their behavior, might change it. And if they don't change it, that they may need to leave the session.
Yeah. So there's a thing there, which is, you know, because we're talking about shame, obviously. And in that situation, you would kind of probably shame that other person, but who said it by calling it out. Or, you know, there's a danger of that happening.
And calling it in, though, I think is the thing to do there. The impulse is to shame and to be Karen, stop it. But the thing that's really helpful is to, you know, even a question like, you know, it can be fairly kind but strong at the same time around, you know, might that comment actually be a reinforcement of all the things we've already been speaking about today? So, you know, things are invitations as opposed to interrogations or, you know, calling out can be something that needs to happen some of the time, particularly if we see our practices working in solidarity with people in the room who have less power, not colluding with, or helping people who have more to feel safe and comfortable.
Yeah. No, I think it's, you know, it's more of an evening out of things as well. You know, an evening, not an evening out, an evening out. It's just the same words. An evening out of the power, about rebalancing of the power dynamics there. And as the person facilitating, although you actually call it convening, that co-design space, you know, you have a lot of, you have extra power, right? Because you literally, you're the one standing at the front with the mic or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that gives you kind of a bigger clout. And so you can kind of rebalance. Now, we're coming pretty close up to time. You're also, you've got the book. You also produce these mindsets guides. There's quite a few other things on your website. You did say earlier you're working on another book. What's it called?
Yes, the new book is tentatively called Beyond Service Design, which evidently there's a beyond theme going on. And this particular book is a question that I'm holding in my head about how is it, as service designers, that we may be colluding with the manufacturing of need and new needs. And this is particularly inspired by John McKnight's work on the Keller Society, in which he makes this observation that perhaps, you know, one of the issues we've run into is not because we don't have enough services, but because maybe we have too many. And maybe there's some areas that have been professionalized to such an extent that we've lost some of our capacities to care for and about each other. And in no way am I suggesting that we don't need some services. For sure, we need acute services, for example. We need people to do surgery on us. We definitely don't want to do that on each other. But there are a whole bunch of other services in which we've invented, and perhaps, you know, as service designers, we're kind of playing in the territory of inventing services, of maybe creating services that people can't stop using or that actually don't build their capability or efficacy in any way. And maybe that's not always the outcome that we're looking for, but whether it should be, particularly in some categories of service, in which we might say community capacity is an outcome we want, but the way in which we go about creating boundaries and structures and services may not reflect that. So it's not particularly well formed, but I've been increasingly talking to folks such as at the Australian Centre for Social Innovation about what they're doing around caring for carers, around building up community resilience after bushfires, around community mental health, and, you know, new models for keeping people out of the child protection system. And the thing that all those projects have in common is they're not services, and they don't get framed in the context of service. They get framed in the context of capability. And right. I'm just curious about some of those things and working through some of the different stories, the different approaches. But importantly, what I'm also asking is, what is that ask of the service designer? And are there some things perhaps that we need to give up, or some ways that we might reframe our own thinking so that everything isn't a service, a better service, a new service, a different service, but we see that there's different directions, different roles, and ideally different outcomes.
I'll be fascinated to see what you come out with. I think the thing, when you just talked about the caring for carers thing, I think there is a, because of healthcare as a classic thing we talk about in service design as one of the kind of big services that will be around, you know, has been around since before we were born, and will be around after we die. And those are the two points we know we access the healthcare service as well, our birth and death. But, you know, one of the things that's going on in Germany, for example, is, you know, with COVID, is that the politicians will talk about, you know, we need another 1,000 intensive care unit beds, but the nurses are all burnt out. And so they're leaving that profession. And actually one in my sort of family circle has done exactly that. And as there was an interview with someone, you know, from an intensive care unit, and they just said, you know, beds don't make people better, right? Beds don't make care for people. If you don't have the staff, the numbers of beds don't make any difference. And he was very frustrated with those kind of political statements, which just didn't really understand the context or what it's like to be, you know, actually working in those services. I think there's a lot of services that, I mean, look at that. And I feel like I'm always kind of loading onto the tech industry here, but you know, the tech industry is obviously full of that. And we think of, you know, Amazon and the rest of them, where you've got, or you know, the content auditors of, you know, people have to kind of view objectionable content from Facebook and all those kind of people. There's all these other services for whom the people in those services aren't really cared for at all. I can definitely, that resonates. So, as you know, the show is named after this Ray and Charles Eames film called Powers of Ten, about the relative size of things in the universe. And the last question is always, what one small thing is either overlooked or underappreciated and could either be redesigned or more well-known that has an outsized effect on the world?
This feels like an extraordinarily difficult question to ask. Look, I'm going to say something that has personal elements to it and it has work elements. And because we've already talked about this a little in the conversation, is I think the thing we can all do better, whether it's to our family, our friends, our colleagues, workshop participants, is just know how to write a really good invitation. We just really fail on that. We fail to make it personal. We fail to make the person like feel like special to some extent and like we care about them or attentive to their needs. I'll provide just a really quick example. As I was hosting birthday party the other day and a friend of mine with autism was coming along and I'd said to her in advance, would it be okay if I burnt some scented candles or would that be really disruptive for you and would that make it really unpleasant to be in my home? And immediately she sort of came back and said, oh my gosh, can't believe you even asked me that. Like, yeah, ideally prefer if you didn't, if you don't mind. And it's like, Right. Well, no, I don't mind. Like, it doesn't affect my experience at all, but it was clearly going to have a really big impact on yours. So invitations, personal invitations, professional invitations, just make them a little bit better, not so very generic. Nice. Yeah. And, you know, I think that would make a pretty significant difference about who's in the room and how they feel about being in the room.
Yeah. You talk about, actually, I meant to ask, let's talk about this before, but you talk about love quite a lot in the book as an important part of this process. Mm. And my biggest complaint about sort of professionalization or, you know, sort of the word even being professional is that it seems to kind of exclude all of that. Exclude, you know, love and emotions and how people feel. That's kind of irrelevant in the kind of hard business world and stuff. And yet, without that, you sort of don't get anything going anywhere, right? Because there's a lot of resistance that people will then push back on. Mm. And do you think it's too extreme to say that when you don't really take into account how people feel about things and how it kind of how they feel excluded or included, it's actually fundamentally people feel unloved?
Mm, absolutely. I mean, I don't think it would be an understatement that it is all of our wish to feel in some way seen and known when we're together. Yeah. And I think that's just as true for a design workshop as it is in family and community. So yeah, I think we've got to talk a lot more about love, and particularly loving all of the contributions that people bring, including the ones that aren't obvious to us or we don't naturally value, or because it's not a professionalized skill and we might have classified it as craft or hobby, that we don't value that. We don't see what that is and what they can bring. And, you know, that's probably drawing a little bit more on the asset-based community development type approaches, in which we just recognize that everyone has gifts to offer, and our role, or at least I see it as our role, to create enough hospitality and safety and warm welcome in which people feel like they can share whatever those gifts are. And I know that sounds kind of soft and fluffy, but it's actually hard and important.
That sounds like a very good place to end the podcast. Thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
Thank you for having me.
As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullane. You can find me at apullane on Twitter, or pullane.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.